I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a radio conversation that loves to be led now and again along the poet's path through anguish to the light. Our guest, Franz Wright, is a decorated practitioner of redemptive conversations with God, prayers out of pain, bursts of starlight, as a commenter writes on our page at radioopensource.org. Scott G. observes, Franz Wright practices an art of emotional silence with the staccato line breaks of a voice somewhere between crisis and awe. I would say he gives us a chronicle of suffering and spirit as if it were written by the Spirit, not by himself. Please join the conversation with Franz Wright and about him with the poet Fanny Howe and the poetry editor Alice Quinn of the New Yorker magazine. Please join the conversation on our website. Post your thought at www.radioopensource.org. Franz Wright, welcome.
Thank you.
It's a great gift, may I just say, for me to pick up contemporary poetry that moves me, I won't say from the first word, but at the end of one reading, it kind of radicalized my head. And I think we should just plunge into the work. Would you be so kind as to read the last poem in your next-to-last book? The book is Walking to Martha's Vineyard, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 2004. And the last poem is called The Only Animal. Franz Wright.
Okay, I'd be glad to. The only animal that commits suicide went for a walk in the park, basked on a hard bench in the first star, traveled to the edge of space in an armchair while company quietly talked, and abruptly returned, the room empty. The only animal that cries, that takes off its clothes and reports to the mirror, the one and only animal that brushes its own teeth. Somewhere, the only animal that smokes a cigarette, that lies down and flies backward in time, that rises and walks to a book and looks up a word, heard the telephone ringing in the darkness downstairs and decided to answer no more. And I understand too well. How many times have I made the decision to dwell from now on in the hour of my death, the space I took up here scarlessly closing like water, and said I'm never coming back, and yet this morning I stood once again in this world, the garden arc and vacant tomb of what? I can't imagine. Between twin eternities, some sort of wings, more or less equidistantly exiled from both, hovering in the dreaming called being awake, where you gave me, in secret, one thing to perceive, the tall, blue, starry strangeness of being here at all. You gave us each in secret something to perceive. Furless now, upright, my banished and experimental child, you said, though your own heart condemn you, I do not condemn you.
I do not condemn you. No condemnation in the language of St. Paul. You is a voice in this poem and in a lot of your poems, and after a while, it becomes clear that this is the big guy. This is as close as we are going to get to God. How dare you?
Yes, it's very embarrassing. All my friends make fun of me.
How does that work? And I particularly want to know how a poet, this is the ultimate trapeze artist's trick to put God in there and get away with it.
I think that appealed to me very much. I mean, I had some experiences that led me to a desire to speak openly or almost openly about some of these matters, and I was perfectly aware that there would be a certain degree of ridicule if I did, and that was all right with me.
Added degree of difficulty.
Yeah.
Is that part of the poet's challenge here? I mean, was this a professional thing?
I'd never been particularly preoccupied with the current fashions in literature, which come and go, and I feel that certain, you know, material presents itself to me as a writer, and I just have to go with the material that is offered to me.
We're talking about a backstory that I know something about, having read your poetry, and most listeners don't. Should we get into that, or would you rather do another poem? I would love to hear the letter of January 1998, and then perhaps you could tell where this comes from.
Well, this is a poem that comes out of... I had reached a point in the late 90s where thought I was sort of at the end of my writing, and personally in a lot of trouble, mentally in a lot of trouble. And I began to visit churches and sit in the back and listen, not taking part formally. And I discovered a tremendous solace and happiness in that situation. And I guess this poem was just an attempt to describe what that was like for me. Letter. It's supposed to be a letter. I think I was writing to my friend Donald Justice, actually. I am not acquainted with anyone there. If they spoke to me, I would not know what to do. But so far, nobody has. I know I certainly wouldn't. I don't participate. I'm not allowed. I just listen, and every morning have a moment of such happiness. I breathe and breathe until the terror returns, about the time when they are supposed to greet one another. Two people actually look into each other's eyes and hold hands a moment, but the church is so big and the few who are there are seated far apart, so this presents no real problem. I keep my eyes fixed on the great naked corpse, the vertical corpse, who is said to be love and who spoke the world into being before coming here to be tortured and executed by it. I don't know what I am doing there. I do notice the more I lose touch with what I previously saw as my life, the more real my spot in the dark winter pew becomes. It is infinite. What we experience as space, the sky, that is, the sun, the stars, is intimate and rather small by comparison. When I step outside, the ugliness is so shattering, it has become dear to me, like a retarded child, precious to me. If only I could tell someone. The humiliation I go through when I think of my past can only be described as grace. We are created by being destroyed.
That was one of those lines that I quoted on our page, Franz Wright, just so exquisitely penetrating and economical and true. Forgive me, but I immediately think of the Hemingway Nobel line that a man can be destroyed and not defeated, and a man can be defeated and not destroyed. But this is saying that we are created by being destroyed.
Yeah, well, my experience ended up being that, I don't know, the things that I experienced as sort of good things and fortunate things often turned into disasters, and the things that I experienced as disasters seem to lead to some possibility of growth and change, and I started to see that things weren't as they appear. You know?
The disasters clearly are integral to the experience, and not only that, to the whole poetic assignment to define another starting point. Maybe you should just talk about how you got there and where you arrived at.
Well, I had been, for one thing, pretty much my entire adult life until about the age of 46, I was a extremely active alcoholic and drug addict. There's no point in concealing that fact. And that had led me to a point of real, finally in my late middle 40s, of very, very serious mental breakdown and a kind of psychotic state, which went on for a couple of years. And I had lost the ability to write and thought that my writing was over completely. And was in, you know, genuine kind of despair. And some things happened. But not after I went through this period for so long that I considered it to be permanent. And then finally something started to happen.
Happen meaning?
Well, I was led to a point where I had really no choice but to die or to try to come back to life somehow. And I went about this partly through the intercession of my wife, Elizabeth, who we got together around that time, and she helped me a great deal to try to get well and gave me a reason to get well. And then I eventually got involved in formal, you know, recovery from addiction, and which I take part in. And I found myself, I'd always found myself stumbling into Catholic churches for some reason. I felt very, like I said, I felt very at home there, and for reasons that were mysterious to me, I just felt safe. And I don't know, I was there one day, and in Waltham, where we had moved, and one day I suddenly came over me, why not make an attempt to formally become initiated into the church and take part in a formal way? And the whole thing meant so much to me, and I was very happy there. And I approached the priest and who I became friends with, and he put me through the formal initiation process, and I was baptized at the age of 47 or whatever it was. And this was a big deal for me. My writing just came back. It came back in a way that had never been there to begin with.
This is in many ways the strangest part of a multiple miracle that from 98, 99 on, you found an enormously productive new voice, and a certain kind of muse had landed and returned in a very prolific way. This was what produced the books we're talking about: The Before Life, Walking to Martha's Vineyard, and God's Silence by Franz Wright. We're talking about light out of darkness in poetry. This is Open Source.
Hi, this is Brendan. I'm the Open Source blogger-in-chief. We've been emailing with a lot of people in both Israel and Lebanon this week. Greta posted an update today from Benny Shlavich in Nazareth, Illit. He was staying put because he thought it was safer. Now the missiles from Lebanon have found his town. Also, David, appropriately enough, has been looking into the story of David and Goliath, how every Goliath wants to be a David, every David a Goliath, and how the real biblical David was not a particularly merciful guy. Sling your shot at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Talking this hour with the poet Franz Wright about his work and about the pain that produced it, but that turned around in a most extraordinary way 6, 7, 8 years ago when he became sober, became a Catholic, and found a new spirit in the writing. How did the writing change? May I first just quote Kate McShane, who writes an email to us saying, I think of Franz Wright the way I think of John Coltrane, kicking a heroin addiction and writing A Love Supreme. Something happens with horrible pain coming through it, and I don't know what, she says.
That's very flattering to hear. I know that in my case, the previous work had been rather lurid in comparison and very... I think what happened in some ways, though, frankly, is that I found myself returning to a state of mind that I had enjoyed as a child and as a teenager before I ever, you know, entered into this sort of went off down this road of addiction. And so it was more like sort of getting back a sort of person or spirit that I felt I originally had, you know, and but then with the ability to maybe write something about it that I had learned through the decades of dealing with technical problems of trying to learn, which turned into very lurid kind of poetry. But I knew a lot of things about how to write, and they just took a different turn. You know?
But it wasn't simply the poetry of recovery, I take it.
No, I hesitate to address that directly. I hope that it enters into what I write. My personality and mind are very different in the absence of the sort of suicidal kind of use of substances. I've returned to a kind of state of mind that I enjoyed before all of that, really. I don't think it's new. I just think it was kind of buried over by...
Franz Reiter, I wish you'd read a poem called The Walk in the new book called God's Silence, and maybe after that, Why is the Winter Light?
Okay. These are both poems I won't talk about that, but all right, I'll read The Walk. More malicious and frightening behavior on the part of inanimate objects. I walked outside today, and the void was shining. Immortal and infinite word, and I have heard God's silence like the sun. For the last time I stumbled into a church where no one was home, silently screaming, "Help me, I can't live. Without you, I don't want to live." I came in the midst of the world, and in the flesh I appeared to you. I seemed to hear this, originless. And I found you all drunk, and no one did I find among you thirsting. Staggered out again and took a look around, and suddenly noticed the others, each wearing that identical expression. What is wrong with me? What's going to happen to me? And I heard again the faceless voice saying, "How can you expect energy from above when you continue to receive it from below and are content?" I am not content.
What were you going to say earlier that you decided you weren't going to say?
I'm not sure. The one thing I could... There are a lot of things I could say about it, but I think maybe it just reflects something that I'm realizing more and more. After the sort of euphoria of discovering all this and of my conversion experience, I, of course, had to return to a sort of normal, you know, reality. And I had to deal with the fact that it wasn't all over with, that it had just started, that I had, you know, I had found a sort of a way to go on. But now it was in my, you know, partly in my hands. Something miraculous had happened to me. I felt I'd been delivered miraculously from the end, what I thought was the end of my life. But now that I had to deal with reality, I had to deal with reality without drugs, and I had to deal with reality with a new sense of, a new sense of spiritual responsibility of some kind. And I find it very difficult. I find myself... One of the reasons I like a poet like George Herbert is because he's the sort of patron saint of people who feel inadequate to even to address God, who feel ashamed and guilty even to pray in some ways. And I think that's an experience that people, believers, encounter because we are... we're never going to really be able to live up to our ideals in that way, but... Well, anyway, I'm just sort of trying to discover this further stage, you know.
Why is the winter light?
I read this. I wrote this down in Fayetteville, Arkansas, a couple of years ago, and during a very difficult, very sort of lonely, anxious time when I was teaching down there. I was by myself, and I was in a bad state again, and that scared me. So at some point it occurred to me that I could perhaps solve this anxiety and loneliness I felt by walking around through the town and looking at other people and imagining what they might be suffering, what affliction they might secretly be going through. And then in that way I forgot about my own. And I also was reminded that a certain degree of suffering is really the norm. It's not some sort of secret punishment or doom that I had been condemned to, that it was sort of the normal condition. I guess that's what I was thinking of. Why is the winter light disturbing, and who, if anyone, shares this impression? If somebody enters the room, am I going to stop being afraid? Why am I afraid to go grocery shopping? I suppose there is a pill for that, but why? Surrounded by so vast a cloud of witnesses, why do I feel this alone in the first place? Is heaven a place? And if so, will our poor, hairy, speechless forebears, all millions of years of them, be there to greet us, if and when we arrive? The meek shall inherit Auschwitz, too, if they're not careful. Where do such obscenities of thought originate? And are the words we speak being mercilessly recorded, or are we speaking the already written, premeditated words? Why do I want to live forever and the next day fervently wish that I had died when I was young? Why do I abruptly feel blessed? And if, and it does, this city harbors a single individual suffering unendurably, am I prepared to take his place? Empty me of the bitterness and disappointment of being nothing but myself. Immerse me in the mystery of reality. Fill me with love for the truly afflicted, that hopeless love, if need be, make me one of them again. Awaken me to the reality of this place, and from the longed-for or remembered place. And more than this, behind each face, induct, oh, introduce me into the halting, disturbed, ungrammatical, soundless words of others' thoughts, not the drivel coming out of our mouths. Blot me out, fill me with nothing but consciousness of the holiness, the meaning of these unseeable, all these unvisitable worlds which surround me, others' actual thoughts, everything I can't perceive yet. No, it is there. This is something I needed to write to get through that time, and sometimes... Not always, but sometimes writing has been able to serve that purpose for me.
Could I just ask, where is that place, the halting, disturbed, ungrammatical, soundless words of others' thoughts? It's a space.
The interior life that we all lead and somehow feel is either a richness that we carry around inside of ourselves that contributes to reality if we're in a good state of mind, or in a more hellish states of mind, I suppose it represents a kind of wall between us and the rest of the human race and of reality, and a kind of imprisonment. So I think we lead this one life inside silently in our minds, and then we lead the life, the polite life we're trying to lead on the outside in objective reality to get along with other people. And I'm interested in what people are really going through. You ask everybody how they are and they're always fine, you know, and we're not fine. I say it all the time, I'm fine. And I'm not. And I'm interested in what people are really going through.
Is it a wordless place?
That they can't communicate. And I, as somebody who has tried to struggle very hard to try to use words and to communicate certain things. In fact, I think the things that interest me most as a subject for poetry are the very things that completely resist articulation.
It sounds like that place where William James said religious experience begins, and perhaps in your place where recovery begins. But I'm also fascinated that it's where poetry may come from too. It's a pleasure to introduce you to Fannie Howe, and Fannie Howe to you, Frantz Wright. Fannie Howe is on the line from Connecticut, a distinguished American poet in her own right. But what's so fascinating to me, Fannie, were two things. One, that you the two of you in a different way plow this very high, ambitious ground of spiritual poetry, and at the same time also that Franz Wright turned out worships you from afar, adores your work, and I thought this ought to be an open conversation. Where is that place that Franz Wright has found this poetry?
Well, from my point of view, I mean, just it's wonderful to hear him talk about his work and to get all the elucidation of the surrounding and the aura around the work. It's just great to hear that. I feel that I really deeply understand what he's talking about for any number of reasons, and so it's also at a kind of humanly sympathetic level. And I feel that the place is actually a kind of extreme secularism. It's not, the words religious and spiritual, for me anyway, don't apply to the sense of absolute horror and shock that he's feeling about being in the world, in the universe at all, and that that leads to an action, which is writing, or it could be doing any number of things, but the action comes out of not exactly faith and a great profound belief, but just the opposite, a huge terror. And that's what I respond to in his work, which seems almost mirroring things that I've tried to do myself.
That's interesting, except that Fanny Howe has managed to express those things in a way that is more subtle and discreet and sophisticated than anything that I could possibly hope to achieve.
Except that, let's talk about terror. There's a lot of terror in this work, Franz Wright.
I think I would call it more a sense of inadequacy. And again, that's why Herbert appeals to me. He's the poet of people who feel that a belief in a need to believe and an almost a shame about it.
But you write about terror. You use that big word a lot. And now I've got to find it. But you write in a poem called One Heart in the Walking to Martha's Vineyard book.
Well, that was my poem of gratitude.
Yes. But one of the things you thank God for is for letting me look at your frightening blue sky without fear and your terrible world without terror.
Mm-hmm.
Benny, is that the terror you're talking about?
Yes, I am. I mean, I just think that is certainly the emotional capsule at the heart of these poems for me, and that he constructs a kind of architecture out of syntax so that the syntax can contain the sounds of each word and each line, can contain that shock the way that you would build a house around a fire or something. It's that's the beauty of it, is to me, in the syntax.
Should we talk about the poet's tricks in this work?
Not much tricks. It's kind of, writing is kind of crude, I think, in that way, but kind of crude and literal.
What are you saying about the syntax, Fanny?
What am I saying? I'm saying that it's like music, that music is made up out of pauses and dots of sound and sort of sparks and shots that seem to be like the template of the brain or the emotional brain, and that the poet can locate the graph of those sounds and feelings, and that's what's there in the work. I'm not interested at all in analyzing or ripping apart poems and talking about them in that way. Mm-hmm. It's more, I do see the musical level as being a syntactical one.
I would agree with that, too, frankly. I mean, I think the strong points are the fact that there's a song-like or musical. There's a attention paid to the musical dimension of language. As far as what's actually being expressed, I'm afraid I'm very much at a beginning level and speaking sort of maybe very literally and naively about very mysterious things. But maybe if there is something that saves the poem, it's just that. Yeah, I'm very interested in the connection between music and meaning in a poem.
Speaking of music, Franz, would you be so kind to read from the God's Silence book? It's a change of pace, and it's the very witty Franz Wright, a poem called "A Successful Day." Fill in the blank.
Let's see, where is that?
Page 133.
Okay.
And I want to come back after that, Fanny, to your contrast between spiritual and secular understandings around your work. But please read "A Successful Day."
Okay. It has been given back all I was denied, and all I then took over denying myself for more than 30 years, a cheerful, self-confident trust that I am at home in this universe, and pity for the afflicted, because as one of the afflicted, I could pity and identify with no one but myself. I would like to give my life the sad and awful simplicity of an early weekday mass with a handful of most lonely humans in attendance. What have I ever gained by it? One, answering the telephone. Two, reading the newspaper. Three, this morning I had supper with the infinite. Dorothy Wordsworth wrote, "A rainy day, I made a shoe."
Why do we laugh? Other than
I'm
after...
simple-minded.
Fanny Howe, we haven't got time before the break to get into the whole story, but say once more the contrast you were drawing between a spiritual framework and a secular sensibility.
Well, I think that people imagine that that spiritual people are drifting around with their heads in the clouds. But what I understand from Franz Wright's poems is the urban church, the urban life of the church is what draws him, not the kind of transcendent drift. And that to me is secularism, is walking into a church at noon, putting your hand on a plastic statue for a minute and walking out again. And that to me is what draws me to the poems.
Stand by, Fanny Howe. We're talking about the poetry of Franz Wright in God's Silence and Walking to Martha's Vineyard. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about the poetry of suffering and recovery and faith and great beauty in the work of Franz Wright, who won the Pulitzer Prize in 2004 and who has had a rather, even to himself, astonishing, prolific energy on the page since his recovery from severe mental illness and addiction in the late 1990s. Franz Wright, I wish you'd just sort of reopen the conversation with a wonderful poem in Walking to Martha's Vineyard called Flight.
Okay. The poem about my father, James Wright.
Should we say that your father also won a Pulitzer Prize. It's an extraordinary little footnote in the Pulitzer history that only one father and one son have won the same prize.
Yes, and it's very strange. It's strange. All right, flight. That glass, was it filled with alcohol, water, or light? At 10, I turned you into a religion. I should say also that I didn't live with my father after I was 7 or 8 years old. We lived on opposite sides of the country. At 10, I turned you into a religion. The solitary 4-foot priest of you, I kept a little manger candle burning. I kept your black half-inch of scripture in the hiding place. Destroyer of the world. That empty glass. In which city was it, in 4th or 5th grade? Mother read in the newspaper you'd be appearing and dressed me up in suit and little tie and took me. I wanted to run to you. Who were all these people? I sat alone beaming at you who could not meet my eyes, and after you shyly approached and shook my hand. If I'm walking the streets of a city covering every square inch of the continent, all its lights out and empty of people, even then, you are there. If I'm walking the streets overwhelmed with this love for the living, I will still be a blizzard at sea. Since you left me at 8, I have always been lonely, star far from the person right next to me, but closer to me than my bones. You are there. It's 1963 again, the old Minneapolis airport so vast to me, and I am running. After the long flight alone, I am running into your huge arms. Now, I am 45 now, and I am dreaming. We are together again. We are both 45. And I have you all to myself this time, and we are walking. Together we're walking down a glowing blue tunnel. We're on time for our flight. I can hardly believe it. We are traveling somewhere together alone. God knows where we are going, and who cares? We're together, walking and happily talking and laughing and breathing.
Thank you, Franz Wright. Our blogger-in-chief, Brendan Greeley, has a thought from the website.
There are several lovers of Franz Wright logging on to write about his poetry. Scott Q writes, Mr. Wright need not take on dramatic personas or mythical identities like a Sylvia Plath, for his own life has carried enough fire and ice to form its own mythical structure. So there's a question in there. When you're writing your poetry, are you aware that people know who you are and they have a sense of your own biography? And is that something you take into account when writing?
That is not something I assumed in the least until maybe, I suppose, in some ways, the last couple. It still never seems real to me that anyone's aware of my work at all, to tell you the truth. But I think over the last couple of years, it became, after the prize happened, it became inescapable that somebody was noticing. And I guess I'm aware of it, but it remains an extremely private preoccupation of mine. And I frankly don't give much thought to a reader when I'm trying to deal with these things. And also, I think I'm writing about them less and less now. And maybe it's a preoccupation that I'm through with. I'd like to write in a more impersonal way, and I'm trying to learn how to do that.
Alice Quinn was noticing your work. Alice Quinn is the poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine, one of the few magazines that still publishes a lot of important poetry. Alice Quinn, how many people are even working the ground that Franz Wright does? And I'm thinking of the spiritual end of the confessional style here.
Well, I suppose I feel that there are a number of contemporary poets who take part in the kind of direct address. Franz may be addressing God more directly in the vein of George Herbert, and with that kindred sense of anguish and the possibility of redemption. But
But I think Henri Cole, Vijay Seshadri, Carl Phillips, perhaps addressing more erotic themes, nonetheless, is trying to reach for a certain transcendence, I feel, that I think is an abiding, very strong, almost imperial quality in Franz's work.
Yeah, and there's people like Mary Carr. Lots of people who
Mary Carr,
unabashedly
exactly right.
sort of writing about subjects like this. And hello, Alice.
Well, Mary is maybe even more in your vernacular.
Yeah,
I was
yeah.
thinking of poets with a different kind of
yeah.
speech.
Yeah.
But I also think that Franz comes down through Hopkins and Herbert, but is strongly an American poet coming down through Bishop and Frost. You know, the wonderful goblet, Franz, at the end of Frost's directive, you know, the goblet that the children used in the playhouse and at the end of this long autobiographical poem, it's got this marvelous biblical ending when Frost says, "Here, drink and be whole again beyond confusion." Mm. That comes to mind sometimes when I read your work, and certainly Hopkins comes to mind. You know, the world is charged with the grandeur of God, and glory be to God for dappled things. And that always brings up for me those beautiful lines of yours about the world's wordless beauties intact and can never be other than intact, or the end of one of your poems, "I can hardly bear the beauty of this world." That kind of contrast between how the gorgeous material beauty and palpable eternal importance of the beauty of the world, and at the same time a certain poverty of feeling that you are able to dramatize. And
thank you.
You know.
Alice Gwynn, thank you. Don't go away either, but I thank you for reminding me of those poems that he must read. The Scribbled Testament in the new book, and is it the Cloudless Snowfall in the first?
Mm-hmm. I'd be glad to read it.
The Cloudless Snowfall, beautiful poem.
Franz Wright, please read it.
All right. Great big flakes like white ashes at nightfall, descending abruptly everywhere, and vanishing in this hand, like the host on somebody's put-out tongue. She turns the crucifix over to me, still warm from her touch 2 years later, and thank you, I say, all alone. Vast wisp-wisp of wingbeats awakens me, and I look up at a minute-long string of black geese following low past the moon, the white course of the snow-covered river. And by the way, thank you for keeping your face hidden. I can hardly bear the beauty of this world. I don't know. What was the other one?
Well, I think this Scribbled Testament.
Oh, okay.
From God's Silence.
Okay. I stand before you here, some hairy primates fall from grace. One of the patients of God, one of the orphans of light, having read the great books of this world only to completely forget them again, having learned how to speak this language only, darken it up a bit, will you, to translate my heart for you from the original silence. In the end, I was simply borrowing it from its inventors, the dead and the brilliant unborn. Forgive me.
The title of this book is God's Silence, and there's a line that keeps coming through it about you've heard God's, except I don't want to get it wrong, God's silence like the sun, explained, I think, in a fashion by the line where you speak of a presence I clearly perceive, the way perhaps the born blind do the sun. But I wish you'd read one of those poems, Franz Wright, about
maybe
hearing God's silence.
Maybe the hawk, I know that's a poem in which that line occurs. The line occurs in different poems throughout the book, and I worried about that for a while, but then I thought, well, after a while it just sort of struck me. It's a long book, and it struck me as a kind of symphonic, you know, a theme with different variations, and so I left it in. All right, I'll read that. The Hawk. Maybe in a million years a better form of human being will come, happier and more intelligent. A few already have infiltrated this world and lived to very much regret it, I suppose. Me, I'd prefer to have come in the form of that hawk floating over the mirroring fire of Clear Lakes Hill, my gold skull filled with nothing but God's will the whole day through, instead of these glinting voices incessantly, unerringly guiding me to pursue what makes me sick and not to what makes me glad. And yet, I am changing. This 3-pound lump of sentient meat, electrified by hope and terror, has learned to hear his silence like the sun and sought to change. And friends on earth at the same time as me, listen. From the sound of those crickets last night, Rene Char said, prenatal life must have been sweet. Each voice, perhaps, also a star in that night from which this time we won't be interrupted anymore. But fellow monsters, while we are still here, for 1 minute, think about this. There is someone right now who is looking to you, not him, for whatever love still exists.
This is where the daily work of charity or healing or just care comes into both your life and your work, Franz Wright. Do you want to talk about that? I mean,
Well, I'm interested in more and more. I mean, for the last. One thing that's been really different about I spent most of my adult life being awfully preoccupied with my own pain, and I think if there's any difference, the last 6 years I got very, very interested in being around people in different forms of affliction, and I use the term affliction almost in the sense that Simone Weil used it. I mean, the sense of genuinely broken people who may not make it back, you know, in a way. I like to be around people who are struggling with addiction, struggling with mental illness. I volunteered for a number of years in a place called the Center for Grieving Children, working with very young children who are experiencing the death of a parent. I'm happy among, I like being around people who are in, struggling with crushing difficult things. I'm much happier. It makes me feel more normal to be around people like that, and that's much more interesting to me, really, than writing. I mean, maybe in some ways it's helped my writing, but more and more that's what I'd like to be involved in.
Anyhow, I wanted to go back to your line about the aura around this work. What more do we need to know to love it?
Well, I think being very present to the time that we live in is part of the American history ever since, probably since the first Gulf War or something, just to be present in the time, your generation living in the turmoil and tragedy of the exterior as well as the interior world, which is now very totally disbelieving but desperately faithful at the same time with fundamentalism. To live in your time aware of all these things makes you, that is your aura, is the time you live in. And that aura is in his work. That's the thing. It's not being anywhere else but present to the time that we're standing in.
There's a poem here, Franz, dated roughly at the start of the war in Iraq. Is that part of what Fanny's talking about? Is it? Well, do you think of it that way?
Yeah, I mean, as a matter of fact, the current Iraq war started on my birthday on March 18th, and that pissed me off. But yeah, I mean, that was the overtly, if there's an overtly, you know, political poem in the book, I suppose that's it.
Could you read it? It's short.
Sure. It's not much, but The Suns, March 2003. I mean, I think I was mainly just thinking about, here we go again. You know, I mean, when I was a teenager and in college, it was the Vietnam War. And, you know, it's hard to escape this feeling of, like, you know, it's happening again. And however different it may be. The Suns, March 2003. Soldiers again, resting under rare shade, which says, we are the trees, we are old, and tomorrow we shall be older still, but unlike you, we will still be here. This horror illusory, if extremely persistent, this Fourth World War with sticks and stones, this month in anesthesia history, this world, perhaps a toy a child is tired of and abandoned. Shrapnel struck the right ass cheek, and hot jagged metal drove straight on, and passing under the bone, it entered the bladder. He dropped, screaming, to his knees, and death was a red fog about him. And at the end, I think it should be obvious, probably to a lot of people, that it's a rewarding of a passage in the Iliad. About a soldier being struck by a spear and dying.
I'm glad you told us. This is poetry about being present in this time. Thank you, Frantz Wright, for sharing so much. Thank you, Fanny Howe. Thank you, Alice Quinn. You can keep talking about the poetry of pain, the poetry of Frantz Wright, the poetry of redemption. You can help us work on the next show is at radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support Physicians for Human Rights, promoting health by protecting human rights, www.phrusa.org. Our show was produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, and Robin Amer, with help from Greta Pemberton, Henry Shepherd, Colin Baker, and Rob Keir. Robin Moore was our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.